We're going to be in the seventh chapter of the Song of Solomon, if you want to be headed there in your Bible. And we're almost done.
One more week after this. One more session after this would be the better way to phrase it.
Yeah, one more session after this. It's, November's getting away from us.
Two more Sundays.
Yeah, after today, two more Sundays. And then we start new Bible classes in December. Mm-hmm. But for now, we need to wrap up the song. The schedule is basically going to fall like this. We're going to finish 7 and even a little of 8 tonight, because once again, Jeff's never met a chapter division he liked.
I buy it on this one.
So we're going to work a little into 8 and divide this at a different place in the chapter break. And then we're going to do our Bible reading next Sunday night, work through our chapters in Acts. So, by the way, if you have some questions about our last 3 or 4 weeks of reading, if you'll pass those along, we'll be happy to deal with those. And then on the final Sunday of November, we'll wrap up with the rest of chapter 8, and that will conclude the song. And hopefully, you're going to go away with a little bit of sense of what these poems are all about. Maybe we should just say a quick word about this segment that we're in. Do y'all remember that right in the middle of the song, there is this, it's not really a wedding, it's the wedding night.
Yeah.
And Jeff and I both kind of see that as being a key marking point in the book, because the poems that go before that are about the courtship.
Right.
At least what we would call the courtship.
And the awakening of desire, but the maintaining of chasteness in that desire. Don't awaken love until it pleases.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think both of those things are going on.
Right.
That you have the blossoming of their romance, and yet the warning.
The temptation that creates.
And now we're on the other side.
Right.
And the poems tend to focus on some of the challenges of, keeping romantic love alive.
And the deepening intimacy.
After marriage.
Right.
So maybe we need to make that point going into tonight, because I think we're going to see that in chapter 7, that it is God's plan that romantic love grow deeper and richer over the course of our life. It's not supposed to die after the wedding night.
That's right. The world's desire to create this idea that married sexual life is boring and unromantic, but the Bible paints a very different picture.
I think that's a good lead-in to what we're going to be reading and talking about tonight. You will see in chapter 7, in this poem here, you will see an important conflict emerging between how the world views sex and how God views it. And I think that's really, really important. I think the poetry not only helps us, let me back up, not only tells us what God had in mind, but it helps us to retain what he had in mind.
Yeah.
And I think in culture, as romantic love dies in a relationship, people look for sinful methods, whether it's within a marriage to go to something like pornography, or go outside marriage, or give up on it altogether in order to light the fire, so to speak, again.
Right.
And so what we have in chapter 7 is another piece, I think, of God's plan for his better way.
Absolutely.
What he wants for it and how to make what he wants happen. So that's a tall order to pick all of that out of one chapter, but I think we'll find it as we go through here tonight. We're just going to take this whole thing as one segment, right?
Right.
So you want to read that?
You want to start with all of it, or just the...
Let's read the whole thing. Let's read... I think it's all one poem.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we can treat it that way. That's right.
Yeah, deciding what constitutes one poem may be the greatest challenge reading this book.
If you ever pick up commentaries on this song, nobody agrees.
Yeah, we're just kind of rolling with that tonight. We're going to treat this one from 7-1 all the way down to 8-4 as a single unit.
And that's a very natural breakup of the text.
I think so. So let's just begin by reading that together. And again, the three questions are on our slide. Just as that regular reminder, as we start through this, first question we're going to talk about is, what do you see? And hopefully by now, you'll see some things you recognize. So as we read through this together, think about that. What do you see in this particular poem?
How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat and circled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Beth Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say, I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. To which she, that's all hymn to her, man.
Right.
She responds, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. And a little bit of a switch of scene, even though we're treating this all as one poem. But now she says, come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early into the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened, and the pomegranates are in bloom. And there I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and no one would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. And I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. And I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases.
So I wanted to be sure you had to read that tonight.
I was thinking that literally in my heart because I know how you do me.
Yeah, it's racy.
It is, man. I'm getting,
I got to teach this to the high school kids Wednesday night.
And my daughter's in there.
Yeah, and your daughter's in that class. That's exactly
right. I trust you.
So as I said when we started this, I'm hoping some of that rings familiar to you because we're seeing some things we've already seen even several times in the book. For example, we have a list again.
Yeah. And in fact, to that point, I mean, literally, hopefully, maybe some of this, you're already starting to intuit what we're going to do with this and what this is going to be about because some of this has happened before. There's some twists that we're going to bring out, but this ought to be becoming a little more familiar.
It's odd to me that now for the fourth time in a book of poetry about love, we have a spreadsheet.
Well, that's a little harsh.
But it's a list where he just runs down her qualities again. You remember that, right? We've seen lists before.
Right.
On the wedding night in chapter 4, that's how the scene opens with him telling her how beautiful she is and literally just going through a list of things he admires about her.
Well, going through what he sees as he looks at her
for the first time.
In the husband's eyes.
I think giving her reassurance.
Well, and that's right. Yeah, we talked about that at that time. You know, reassuring a very vulnerable woman who's giving a man a very precious gift of herself that he is delighted with what's happening.
And then we have another list in 5 after their conflict with the daughters of Jerusalem challenge her to see his good qualities. And so she does. She gives us a list of them.
That's right.
And then in chapter 6, he gives his
list
on the back end of their conflict.
That's right.
I think affirming that his love for her has not changed. And so before we're done, we have list number 4 where he describes her. And interestingly, it's redundant, isn't it?
To a point, yeah.
Some of the same features.
Right.
Eyes, hair, mouth, neck, breast. He describes the same things he has described before. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, describes them in the same way. And he uses the same process.
Right.
You know, essentially, in 4, he started from her
head
and went to her feet, and now he starts from her feet and works his way up.
That's
And there's the same kind of, I use the word progression in my notes. That may not be the best word, but what we have here is the words and him describing her that then move into the lovemaking, right?
Right.
And that's similar too. We saw that in 4 as well.
Right.
So a lot of things that are familiar here, which makes us wonder about the differences.
Well, that's the thing, is one of the things that happens when you're reading, you know, literature of any sort, is when you see something that follows the same pattern, a lot of the same words and structure, the differences therefore all the more are meant to be highlighted and emphasized. That's a way of emphasizing what we're going to see is different here this time, as opposed to what has come before. So those really are kind of the key to making sense of this.
Yeah, that's actually just a good general Bible study.
Anytime
clue,
you're
isn't
reading,
it? when you're encountering something in the text that sounds very familiar to what I've seen before, it's worth noting the similarities,
right,
but maybe even more important is saying, okay, but how is it different this time?
Yeah. In fact, now you've done it, because now you got me going. Because that's exactly right. But
it almost sounded threatening. I wasn't sure where you were.
Oh, no. My daughter is in your class right now.
Yeah,
no.
Definitely.
But to that point, David, and sometimes people say the Bible is kind of boring, because in lots of places in the Bible, it's repetitive.
Yes.
And there's a reason for that. And sometimes it's, you know, the subtle change is what that's its way of highlighting that. But sometimes, not the case tonight, but just you prompted me, so I can't help myself. Sometimes it's what's missing in the list that was there the first time. What's missing in the repetition is the way the Bible's getting your attention to what's going wrong or what's going right. So anyways, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. I think that's a good Bible study clue.
That's right.
And here,
that's right,
the interesting thing is, if you went back and you laid chapter 4 and chapter 7 side by side, what you would find is 7 is longer. The list is longer.
Yes.
There are 7 more items or features that he includes that's not found in chapter 4. Isn't that interesting? So the deep...
And take note of what they are. And that's all we'll say at this point.
Well, yes. And then even the features he's appreciated before, he's going to describe in new ways.
And they're richer descriptions than what came before.
Yeah. So clue number one to ponder here is we have a very similar list. It looks very much like the wedding night. But there are differences, and we'll talk a little bit later when we get into what does it mean about the significance of that. And then in 10, 10's kind of a pivotal verse, isn't
right,
it?
Right, right.
Doesn't this sound familiar, verse 10? I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Y'all remember that? Because she has said that kind of thing before, back in chapter 2 and verse 16, during their courtship.
Right.
My beloved is mine and I am his.
Right.
And then after the argument in chapter 6, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Though interesting this time, it isn't sort of that equal balance. I am his and he is mine. I am my beloved's and his desire is
right
for me.
And that, because the impact of the raciness of verses 1-9, she realizes how much he delights in her and is in love with her and is deeply satisfied with her.
Well, of course that's going to be here, because
right,
the book is about God's view of sexual intimacy. And so again,
right,
the focus is going to be there. And then finally, the last thing we have in this chapter is a lovemaking scene. So that begins around verse 11 and goes all the way through to verse number 4. And so we have several figures there, particularly if you look at chapter 8 and verse 3, let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. That's an exact quote from we saw back in chapter, I think back
two.
In chapter 2, where you had the same kind of language used. So interesting, you have, if you want to think, I hate to impose some kind of rigid poetry on structure on poetry, rather. That feels out of place. But if you wanted to divide the chapter, there is the list, and then it pivots in verse 10, and you have the lovemaking. And then the ending is kind of odd, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, at the end of
you mean verse 4 by the end?
Verse 4, yeah.
The
lovemaking scene in chapter 4 ends at the beginning of 5 with this celebration. Drink deeply, O lovers, and imbibe. You know, they're encouraged in what they've just done. You have the very opposite here. I swear to you, O daughters of Jerusalem, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. That is also familiar, isn't
right
it?
Right, yeah, that's been a refrain elsewhere in the book as well.
But only before the
right
wedding.
Right. But again, there's something different here this time.
But now it pops up after the wedding, which again seems kind of odd, but that's that warning that we see three times in the book. You got to wait for the right time.
Right.
And so it pops up here. So that's what we have, a list and a lovemaking scene with a weird ending.
Right.
So the question is, what does all that mean? What do we do with it? So let's go back and talk a little bit about the list, because Jeff and I have kind of primed that one a little bit. So what's the significance in the list in chapter 7? What sets it apart from the other ones?
Well, I mean, you've already mentioned several of the things. I mean, it's longer, right?
It is longer.
And it's longer because there are more items.
There are more items.
And the items that are present this time show that he has grown in what he can praise her for. And so they've spent enough time together. He knows her better. And it's not just a relational knowledge. It's a physical knowledge. They are married now. And so he can describe her body in ways that he couldn't, you know, even after the wedding night, because of this deepening experience of life and love together that leads to deeper knowledge. That's the thing, is I think that there has been growth in their relationship, however long they've been married.
And so you can start with that on a rather broad scale and just say that over the course of married life, generally, we ought to come to know each other better.
You know, don't ever forget, you know, no matter how the modern translations render this, you know, in the Old Testament, you know, the King James preserves this, and the New King James, maybe the New American Standard, you know, sexual knowledge is described as sexual experience is described as a knowledge in the Bible. Adam knew his wife and she conceives. And so that's the thing, is the Bible, it's not this pornographic, you know, purely visual, you know, simplicity. It's a knowledge of a person that the Bible sees that as. And so his knowledge of her has deepened.
Well, and so to me, that would be one area where knowledge needs to grow over the course of married life.
Right.
So like I said, if you back out and get the bigger picture, all throughout our life together, we ought to come to know each other better. Think about Peter's language in 1 Peter 3. A husband is to dwell with his wife. The old King James says, dwell with your wife according to knowledge.
Right.
Or the NASB says, dwell with her in an understanding way. The idea is getting to know her better over the course of married life.
Right.
And then this would be one segment of that men and women over the course of married life ought to come to know each other sexually better,
right,
understand each other's needs better and preferences better, and learn how to become highly skilled at addressing those.
And at the same time, take ever deepening, you know, and this is again how you protect against adultery, take ever deepening delight in the other. Which, you know, again, you know, the way he praises her, she can see and feel his delight in her and feel secure in that and giving her to himself sexually. Because if you stop and think about it, the lovemaking scene, it's her voice. She takes the lead. He has, you know, primed her in a way with his praise and his manifestation of his delight in her. And so we certainly, you know, do it for the other, but part of what we show the other is that delight in them.
So really, really important to say that dimension of a married life should not be allowed to grow stale and routine and monotonous. The picture that God has in mind for those of us who are married, that part of the relationship continues to grow and mature over the course of a lifetime. And maybe there we're identifying one of the reasons that people wind up being unhappy in their marriage, or to the point of the book, unhappy in their sex life in marriage, is because it isn't something where they see the need for growing and maturing and understanding each other.
Right. Or again, you know, the damage, we kick this around from time to time, but the damage that pornography does to, you know, especially our younger people who come into marriage, wrong expectations, wrong views, they literally don't know how to grow in this. And that's, again, where parents, elders, preachers can help young people grow into a better sexual knowledge.
So, you know, Kendricks messaged me last night in the middle of this presentation that we were doing and said, if you guys will just stop talking about sex, people will start chiming in with messages. So just mark it down. We're at 5:30, Kendricks. No messages, no questions from anybody tonight. Just thought that was interesting to point out.
You know what you've done now, don't you?
Oh, the troublemakers are really getting ready to light us up. I know, it's coming.
Yeah.
So we ought to say a word about how he chooses to describe his wife in the list, because I want y'all to know the high school kids are really having fun with this. I mean, they just find the list really, really hilarious. Verse 4, your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. When is that ever good? When is that ever romantic? And the other one, what really bugged me was, you know, your belly is like a heap of wheat. How can that ever in any setting be a good thing? And so I'm getting peppered with this every Wednesday from the high school kids. You know, what is this about? So
sure.
Maybe it's worth commenting on at least a few of these, because they are kind of bizarre to us, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Though, to be fair, I think if they saw one of our Hallmark cards today, they'd say, what in the world, from their perspective. At the end of the day, it's what? It's a farming, agricultural world. It's a world that does not live by, you know, the Marvel movies and the CGI and the Adobe Photoshopped pictures where, you know, that are more color saturated in the real world, airbrushed, cropped, you named it. They knew and understood natural beauty. And the world as God made it was still their world. They weren't living in this more controlled and modified world that we live in. And so not only that, I mean, these are all images from their world. And part of it is cultivating the romantic and again, you know, especially for married people, the sexual imagination when you look at this. I mean, rounded thighs like jewels, the work of a master's hands. He likes how her legs are shaped. And they're well shaped, just like a jeweler. You know, takes a, you know, you ever seen a gemstone before it's been worked on by a jeweler? It's just kind of a red rock or a orange rock or a blue rock. You know, by the time the jeweler gets through with it, it's been shaped, it's beautiful, it's set in a piece of jewelry, and it takes on something. Belly like a heap of wheat. You know what he's really, you know, surrounded by lilies. What he's really saying is, you know, you see a heap of wheat and it's tied off. What's he saying? He's saying she's got an hourglass figure. You know, that you know, like you tie a sheaf of wheat in the middle so you can carry it. Very much complimenting, you know, the way he sees the shape of her body.
I think he could have said that better. Hourglass would have been good.
What did I say? Now I'm scared.
No. Okay. I said I think he could have said that better.
Oh.
I don't know. Heap of anything doesn't sound like a good way to start
She's
describing your
girl.
Wife. Okay,
She's
I got
farm
you. I got
girl. You. You know, navel.
You see the problem though, right? It really is unique to a culture. And I think you're right. I think if people from that culture heard the way we describe each other, I've made this joke before. Would there, if ladies, if you're watching your husband play basketball and said, boy, you were really a beast tonight, would that be good? I don't think they would think so. I think, why did she call him that?
Right. Or maybe even, David, in the way we take this too, is just to think about is, you know, every couple has their own love language as they get to know each other.
Yeah, and designations for each other?
I
don't want to know, because some of those are weird
I don't either,
too.
So don't tell me. Yeah. But no, you think about that. I mean, every couple has the language. And she's a farm girl, right? I mean, you know, members from the vineyards and everything else. So, you know, if this is the world that she knows and this connects with her, then that's the language he speaks to her. And again, there's a lesson in that for us, even if their particular intimate language is a little odd to us. He's speaking her language because we see what happens, what is that, in verses 9 and 10. We see what happens. She got the message.
And responds,
absolutely.
So verse 10 we identified as being sort of a pivoting verse between mm-hmm. the list and the lovemaking. And
right.
Interesting, again, this is a phrase that's repeated over and over again in the book. But now on the other side of the wedding night, mm-hmm. she is saying still his desire is for me. And that's interesting.
Right.
Because over time it didn't go away.
Right. And, you know, again, you know, even you think about the problems of our sexually promiscuous culture and the hookup culture of young people, you know, the risk a woman runs always in those situations, once you've given him the most beautiful and precious gift you can give, will he still want you? And she realizes that he is still there. He has not taken from her the one truly, you know, unique thing that a woman can give to her man and run. He stayed and he's deepening and his eyes are only for her.
So picking up at verse 11 and following that, again, this starts sounding really familiar because she invites him to go into the country.
Yep.
Which, going back to chapter 2.
And even chapter 1 a little bit.
In chapter 2, he actually comes to her mm-hmm. and says, hey, come along with me. Let's go out into the country. Let's see if it's going to be springtime again. And again, we get that in verse 12 with the vineyards blossoming and that whole springtime figure we've encountered again and again with them. But this time, it is clear that she's inviting him out to go out with her because she is interested in making love to him, which is how this is ultimately going to culminate. Do you think there's significance to the fact that on this occasion, she appears to be initiating at least the trip to the country?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, that's the thing, is he has, because he has expressed this deep knowledge of her and desire for her, she's responding by saying, yes, let's go. And again, and so now she's taking the lead. You know, you go back to those early chapters you just mentioned, the fear, the trepidation, the hesitation sometimes that even you kind of sense there. And they're not married yet, but even still, she feels a vulnerability and developing a relationship with him. But now, you know, they're married. He's not left. They've even been through some marital bumps and reconciled, at least as the poem unfolds. And then yet, you know, he's still speaking sweet, you know, more than sweet nothings in her ear, so to speak. And she's all in.
Maybe, boy, that's maybe something that we should have thought about, is looking at this in view of 5 and 6 where they have that conflict. And now what we find is not only there did the love remain, but now on the backside of that, it's grown and gotten even richer and deeper. And so a bump in the road doesn't have to mess you up forever, does it?
Well, not only that. I mean, I think that's right. But not only that, I think part of the point is, you know, that's marriage too. And those who, here's the irony maybe too we can make out of it, those who stick through the hard times in marriage, you know, which everybody has.
Oh, that's a great point.
And some want to leave. The reality is this kind of intimacy, this kind of delight, David, this kind of satisfaction only exists for those who stick it out and get past the hard times. And, you know, not only do you heal or can you overcome, but literally the best stuff is for those who have overcome.
Now, there is sort of a binding of someone even closer together when you've been through something together.
Yeah, when you have a story.
Yes.
When you've got a shared story, that gives you, again, if you'll keep writing the story together, that keeps the intimacy growing. Because, again, the more you have, the more you remember, the more you're living one life. I mean, that's the longer the story is, the more it's become one life for both of you.
So 13 is interesting. The mandrakes have given forth their fragrance, and over our doors are all choice fruits, both new and old, which I have saved up for you, my beloved.
Yep.
Let's talk about the old and new fruit.
Right. You know, I mean, that's, you know, some, the old is where they, what they've been and what they've done. They have a history now. And so the old is where we've been and what we've done and the experiences we've had and the knowledge we've had, you know, our memories of our wedding night, our memories of those early days and so forth. But the new fruit is stuff still growing. You know, anytime, you know, how do you know a fruit tree's getting to the end of its life?
Stops producing fruit. Stops
producing fruit. Mm-hmm. That's not them. They're, you know, and again, the image of, you know, this is over the doorpost. It's the symbol of their household, their family, them. You know, what's growing over the doorpost is still producing fruit.
And I wonder, too, if it isn't even more narrow than that, because this is wrapped up in the lovemaking scene in this part of the poem. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if he specifically has in mind sexually. She has brought old things and new things, or things they've learned about each other that have been part of their lovemaking all along. And as exploration continues over a lifetime, there are new pleasures that are discovered, which keeps that part of their relationship from growing stale.
That's right. Part of the adventure of a long-term marriage is the discovery even of different things about each other's bodies. I mean, given what this book is about fundamentally, even about each other's bodies and ways that we can connect that produce new fruit in the relationship.
So who knew somewhere in the Bible it actually said couples are supposed to try out new things sexually? It's actually in the Bible. Who would have thought? Now, I don't know about the rest of y'all. Is 8 in verse 1 just weird? I mean, I just read that and thought, oh, that you were like a brother to me. What husband would ever consider it endearing for his wife to say, oh, you're like my brother who nursed at my mother's breath? If I found you outdoors, I would kiss you. And now it just really gets weird. And nobody would despise me either. So verse 1 may be among the most bizarre in the whole book.
Sure.
Oh, that you were like a brother to me. Why would that ever be a good thing for a wife to say to her husband?
Well, this is just one of those moments of cultural whiplash again, just like her neck is like a tower and her nose is like a, it's their world. And at the end of their day, in their world, you know, women's propriety meant that in public, all they could really be seen with, let alone touch or show any kind of affection for, was a father or a brother.
Yeah, very different than our culture.
Very different than our culture.
Where outward expressions of affection, at least in some cases, are expected. I mean, if you were at my house and we were leaving in the morning and I didn't kiss my wife goodbye, somebody might say,
"What's wrong?"
Yeah. Why weren't you affectionate to your wife before you left?
In fact, we're actually the exact opposite now. Back then, your brother could kiss you and your husband better not. Whereas today, your husband better kiss you, and I'm worried about your brother if he kisses you.
Yeah. Well, but the truth is that there's a reason in that culture for that.
Because, absolutely.
You know, a father might greet his daughter with a kiss on the cheek, or brothers and sisters might do the same thing. There was nothing sexual attached to
that.
It was familial.
That's
but
right.
A husband and wife who did it.
That's right.
There would be something sexual
That's
attached
right.
to that. And hey, keep that indoors.
And in our more sexualized culture, where so much has already been laid bare on the TV screen, the movie screen, the music, and the billboards all around us, yeah, I mean, we do put more out there.
So it doesn't get better because verse 2 is strange as well.
Yeah, it keeps getting worse if, in it one
does.
Sense.
So, well, let's talk about this business of bringing him into her mother's house and drinking the juice of the pomegranates. Why don't you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, it's tasteful poetic imagery for lovemaking, for sexual encounter. Why would she bring him into the mother's house? Because that, you know, the mother's house is the idea of where I was conceived. You got to remember, folks, in the ancient world, love making and having babies went together. We've separated that in our culture. We kind of, you know, we choose when we have babies, you know, through modern medicine and things like that. In the ancient world, they didn't have all, you know, the pill and things like that. And so love, you know, lots of love making led to what? Lots of babies. And so she sees herself kind of sitting in the, you know, entering into the circle of life. She goes to her mother's house in the same sense that what we're doing will make me a mother, you know, who used to teach me. And so, you know, this lovemaking is also, and again, David, they're getting further into the marriage, right? You know, what's the old saw go? You know, so-and-so sitting in a tree, K-A-S-S-I-N-G, first comes love, then comes marriage,
Are
then
you
comes.
Are you old enough to know that?
Remember, I'm older than you, according to the kids.
That is true. One of the kids came up to me last Sunday night.
Story doesn't need to be told.
And it said, so Jeff's older than you, right? Such a great moment.
For who? Anyways, but yeah, you know, that's just part of it. And so that's what, you know, as we're getting towards the end of the book, the fruition, pardon the pun, of this marital life, you know, they're deepening sexually and their knowledge of each other, their enjoyment of each other, but you know, be fruitful and multiply. And so by, you know, her recognition of, and, you know, and for the woman especially, you know, that prizing of motherhood. And so let's go to my mom's house. That's not as creepy as it sounds in their culture. She who used to teach me how to become a woman, how to become a mother, all of this. And I would give you my spiced wine to drink the juice of my pomegranate. So remember, the garden is a metaphor, right, for the sexual encounter. One of the fruits of her garden is what she's offering him. And but that pronoun's important, my pomegranate. And she's going to let him have her in kind of a closing of the circle of life. And again, the anticipating the fruitfulness of their marriage, that their love, their delight will be literally fruitful.
Somebody asked if the heap of wheat then could somehow be reflective of the point you're making, and that is a plentiful harvest.
Oh, that's interesting.
I thought about that.
That's clever. I mean, my narrow-mindedness, I think, you know, he's worried, you know, let's be stereotypical. She's ready for the babies. He just wants to keep looking at her.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the thing. I think at the end of the day, but that is an interesting observation. But yeah, just I think he's enamored with her, and she's just got a nice figure.
Somebody commented on verse 13. They said, great application to us, married 40 to 50 years. The physical attributes certainly change, but the romantic love can continue. That's a good point.
That is. And along that line, I mean, that's part of the thing is as our bodies change, we keep exploring and figuring out how we do this in our marriages at year 30, year 40, year 50.
And then let's talk about 4, because chapter 8, verse 4, mm-hmm. Because we have that admonition again that we saw twice before they were married, but seems oddly placed here, but maybe not so oddly, because what we're reaching is the end of the book.
Right. Time to start tying some things up.
And the time has passed through this relationship. But maybe what she's saying here at the end is this was done the right way.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's how we've been reading the refrain since earlier in the book. There's a right time and a right way to use the God-given gift of our sexuality, male and female. And so it was a warning, even to herself, to them earlier, but now this side of the wedding and even anticipating potentially children coming out of this, this is the right way that you enter into the Garden of Eden and be fruitful and multiply and everything else.
Yeah. And so she goes back, in essence, kind of where they just started when desire first began to break out and they felt this strong passion for each other. And there's the cautionary note, wait. And right. They did.
Right.
And now you run this through life and they look back and say, yes, and that was the right way to do it.
And again, and in one sense, it heightens the delight because there's no regrets and consequences and the baggage that can come from that.
Yes, and trying to separate sexual intimacy from the broader relationship that you've shared with this person
right. Your
whole life.
That's right.
It's not the same.
No.
So I think that's a great place to take young people. Mm-hmm. The three times that the book says, don't awaken love until it pleases, that's a great thing to show young people as we're trying to teach them the message of Scripture about sex.
Right.
That both before and after, no regrets. This is the way God wanted
that's
it
right.
to be. And now that we've been through the whole process and lived our lives together, no regrets. It's the way that it ought to be.
That's right. No scars, no lingering. That's right.
So somebody commented before we move to our last segment that thinking back on the husband's list, it's the same way God speaks to our heart. He kindly tells us our value and how beautiful we are to him, no matter how long we've been a Christian. Thus, we desire to serve, submit, and please him in the way that we live,
which
remember, our relationship with each other in marriage is paralleled by Paul.
Yeah, by design.
To Christ's relationship with the church.
That's right. But by design, I mean, literally, in a sense, God, I think, put marriage into the world as a training ground, as an object lesson, so that we can better understand his love for his people in Christ and the church. And so it's exactly right. The same dynamics are in play. And so learning to do marriage well is a way of better understanding what God's up to in human history.
I think it helps us love each other to remember that God keeps loving us with our flaws and our battle scars and our failures that we've had along the way. Mm-hmm. We've got about 15 minutes to take that last question and talk a little bit about applications.
Sure.
I think there are just some really important ones, not the least of which is the way that I think this segment, 7:1-8:4, really speaks to one of the lies that the world is trying to tell us about sex.
Right, absolutely.
And I think one of the lies that's out there, listen, I think our kids are believing this, which is one of the reasons it's so important that we teach this to young people. I think our kids are believing this lie that it is the person who is having sex with lots of people and little commitment, that is really the one who's having great sex.
Right.
And it's people who limit themselves to one person for your whole life. Do you realize that's mocked and ridiculed in our culture? Just one person? You're going to sleep with one person your whole life? Who would want to do that?
Or even those who, preserve themselves for marriage. You remember, what was it, about 10, 15 years ago, that Steve Carell movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and where the whole idea was, the joke was, here's a guy who's 40 years old,
And he's waited.
And that was supposed to be a comedy about
how
that.
How bizarre is
that's
that?
That's right.
And so it's an element of the hookup culture.
Well, that's right.
That says, I don't even need to know you.
Right.
I don't even need to know your name. We meet up in a bar. There's a connection between us. We go home and sleep together. Get up the next morning. Go our separate ways. No
right.
attachment, no commitment to each other.
Right.
the mantra of our culture is it's just sex.
Well, and what happens with that, David, is because of that, you know, not only do we have the hookup culture among young people, but marriage rates are crashing among young people. And it's not just because they, you know, they'll have the fruits of sex outside of marriage. While they're also giving up on marriage is because they're assuming that these hookup sexual encounters are the end and the limit of what a sexual relationship can be. And so they literally don't believe in romantic love as possible. They think if this is all sex is after I've had 5, 6, 10 partners through, you know, college in my 20s, and if this is all sex is, I'm jaded. I don't, you know, they have no vision, no sexual imagination, if I could put it that way, of what this could be, that what the song is describing. That, you know, ironically, one of the ways I heard somebody put it once is if the world thinks a great lover is one man having many women, the Bible's view is a great lover is one man who can satisfy one woman her entire life. That's the mark of a great lover.
So that's the message of chapter 7.
That's right.
That here you have this couple who have been married now, and I think the idea of the poem is married for a while, because we're on the backside of even some of the marital struggles they've been through. And the idea is that they still have this passionate romance with each other. His list is only longer about her.
That's the point. I mean, that's right. It's getting more interesting the longer we do this together. So, I mean, literally, Dave, I don't know about you, but literally the part of the book that makes me blush the most, or the most I'm scared about you teaching my daughter, is chapter 7.
Wednesday night, buddy.
Appreciate that.
Wednesday night.
But you know, it's the part of the book that's at the end, literally. That's the raciest part of the book. Deep in their marriage.
So think how counterculture this is.
That's right.
That what God is saying is, yes, this is precisely what I have in mind, that one man and one woman are going to come together and spend the rest of their lives just with each other, just making love with each other and no one else. And the plan is, and I think that's found in the poetry here, the longer list that we have, that that's meant to grow deeper and richer all throughout their life, as we come to understand each other better, know each other's needs better, and get better at making each other happy.
Right.
So it occurred to me as I thought about that, that there is a logic to that, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
So think about the cultural message. Think about the hookup culture. Two people meet in a bar, they've known each other 3 or 4 hours, and they go back to someone's apartment. How much do they know about making love to each other? I mean, seriously. How good can that experience be with no sexual experience with each other?
Right.
And hardly even knowing each other?
Right. Especially if in the Bible, you know, the height of sexual experience is a knowledge of the other person. Then it falls badly. And I don't know, I mean, you know, I think, you know, part of what the song is trying to tell us about this and what young people need to hear is that what makes sex not just enjoyable, because enjoyment has its limits. I mean, that's why, again, I think you hook up people, you know, kids get after 10 partners, they figure out this is all sex is in a purely biological way, because there's no relationship in it. What makes sex not just enjoyable, but more importantly, meaningful, is the commitment that comes with two people together over the long haul. That's what makes sex not just enjoyable, because eventually something's not enjoyable anymore, we want something new or different. That's why pornography always descends into something worse. It's stripped sex of meaning. And the song says, no, 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 no. There's meaning in this, but it has to be two people together doing this.
Which just makes perfect sense when you stop and think about it, that two people who share that experience together over a lifetime and who genuinely love each other, and going back to what we see in the song, who are addressing and working that element of their relationship, would just make love better and better and better over
right.
a lifetime. Now, the interesting thing is, there's actually statistical data that backs this up, that the people happiest in their marriage, more likely not to divorce, and who, according to the survey, say they have better sex, are the people who come into marriage virgins and only share that experience with this one person their whole life. I shared that with someone recently, and he shared later, he said, I didn't know if I believed that, so I went back and looked it up. So if you're on your phone right now Googling it, you can find it. The data's there, and it's shocking to people in our world. folks who've studied that said, we couldn't believe that this was the finding. I don't think you have to have a survey to back up what God said. He's right,
right.
Whether the survey agrees with him or not. But in this case, it's one of those few examples where the survey does agree with right. what God has said all along.
That's right. And you know, what happens, I think, too, David, is, you know, and what young people don't understand is because we do have from the culture this, it's just sex mentality, as though it's just some sort of purely biological act that can bring pleasure, like doing other things with our bodies that bring pleasure. At the end of the day, you know, sex, you know, it's not something that can be quantified. It's something that can be put in a test tube. It's something about our spiritual nature. Sex is meant to bond people together. And that's why it's supposed to be one man, one woman, only with each other, virgins in marriage for life, because it's meant to bond. And so the problem is, you know, and the reason shacking up doesn't work out for people is without that commitment, and we tried this with several people because we're going to keep on, you know, they think this is how we figure out who the one right one is. You've probably heard this done too, but I think it's this image too. I think it's exactly right. You know, sexual activity is like a piece of tape where it only sticks so many times. And you begin to weaken the power of its ability to bond us together. That's why, you know, shacking up before you get married never works out. Well, I say never, that's a dangerous word, but does not work out as well.
Statistically
does not work out as well as in the worldly perspective, a worldly common sense would say it ought to. Take it for a test drive before you buy it. That's not how sex works.
Not the way the Creator designed it. So look how important it is that our kids hear about this. I appreciate, folks, that the hookup culture is the culture they live in. And that's the message they hear. It's about lots of partners. It's about no commitment. How important is it that they hear the other side, that they get what's in this book? Now, we do need to address something because I'm wondering, I'm surprised it hadn't popped up here. Nobody's texted it to us. If this is God's plan, what in the world's going on with Solomon? Because he sure was following what looks like the world's plan and not God's plan.
That's right.
So maybe that's one of the purposes of the song.
Well, sure.
Is a repudiation to polygamy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, whether you take this as a book written by Solomon and his confession, regret, you know, or whether you take it as somebody naming Solomon and repudiating him, the bottom line is the same, which is, you know, stereotypically, you know, the one man and many women, the polygamy and the, you know, or bigamy. Or even today, I mean, you heard this term in our culture now, open marriages, you know, where husbands and wives agree to you know, have multiple partners with each other's approval. And this book just says, no, the good stuff that God left for us is found in the commitment of marriage, one man, one woman.
Yeah, I think regardless of who you did, and Jeff and I have spent the last 2 months having this conversation.
Oh, more about, than that. I mean, we've been having this conversation for years.
Actually, that's true.
It is.
About who wrote the Song of Solomon. But whoever wrote it.
The point is the same.
I think it's a repudiation of Solomon.
Absolutely.
And it's saying he didn't have it right. It would even be better if he wrote it because it would be sort of his own confession at the end of his life that, you know, I tried the other way and it didn't work.
Yeah.
One last thing. We really ought to say something in the time we have left. Because I think this is really an underlying thought all the way through this particular poem, and that is the need to grow in our relationship. Maybe the most important takeaway from the section or from the poem is that over a lifetime, marriage ought to grow richer and better, ought to understand each other better. I think that's a piece of what Peter is saying in 1 Peter 3:7 when he says to dwell with your wife according to knowledge.
Right.
Because she is a woman, as with a weaker vessel, so that your prayers would not be hindered. And I think that's requiring us to set out on this expedition when we begin married life to figure out this other person that I've been agreed to be bound together with for life.
Right.
And to become the expert on meeting her needs in every facet of life and in the context of this book, in the sexual dimension of our relationship.
Right. Absolutely.
So maybe we need to give more thought to not allowing relationships to become stale.
Right.
And growing those relationships, knowing each other better. And again, another thing that we ought to talk to kids about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wedding night is supposed to be the beginning. I think Jeff and I both spend some time in the Song of Solomon. We do premarital counseling.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's usually my last session right before the wedding. Because I don't want to awaken love before it pleases. And because we you know, with me, we talk pretty frankly about what's going on there, and setting expectations about the wedding night. And to your point, I mean, I call it amateur night. You know, and but even to build on what you're saying, David, you know, the problem in the church too long has been, you know, we encourage our people to stay out of sexual immorality. And if, you know, and as parents, if we could get two virgins to the wedding night, we're ready to high five each other all the way around. We've done a good job. We've done our work. But too often then we let the culture take over from there with our young couples. And that's a problem, because then our young couples go into marriage thinking that per the movies, the TV, the music, I mean, shelter your kids all you want. It's out there and it's in the culture, right? They've picked up on this by the time they're in their 20s. You know, the culture teaches that, you know, people just jump in bed and the magic happens. And so actually, in my experience, and David, you'll jump in here. A lot of young couples may struggle sexually, feeling like there's something wrong with them early in their marriage, because we think we've done our job when we get to marriage. It's just starting. And the truth of the matter is, this is cultivated. That's the right word, I think. This is cultivated over the long haul. It's not now, it's green light, go, and it's all just going to fall into place immediately. Chapter 7 is at the end of the story.
Yes.
And boy, do we let some of our young people sometimes, I think, struggle in silence.
I think that is such an important point. And right. I do think that at some point before our kids reach their wedding day, that dad needs to sit down with his son, and mom needs to sit down with the daughter and lower expectations for the wedding night, because it is amateur hour.
Yeah.
And they are just starting, and it doesn't happen like you think it happens
right.
in the movies. Or think especially about how much our kids are exposed to pornography. It's not going to go like what you see in the porn movies. And so culture has created huge, huge expectation going into the wedding night.
Right.
We need to prepare our kids that even sexual intimacy grows and matures over a lifetime, and there may be some challenges early on.
Right.
How can we not prepare our kids for that reality?
But that's exactly right. But part of what you leave them with, and you know, it's part of what the song does, is, you know, when we do premarital counseling, is, but the best part is you get to figure this out together.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have your own poetry. You're going to have your own story. You're going to have your own images. And it's just going to be yours. And that's part of the fun of this. That's part of the adventure. That's what keeps it fresh and interesting, is we've got to figure this out together.
Hey, thanks for shooting in some comments tonight. Really appreciate that. Let's pray together before we wrap up. God, it's been a blessing to be with your people tonight. Consider the message of this great book, and may it inspire us, Father, to grow marriages that bring you honor and glory. And may we be inspired tonight to be sure that we provide our children with the message of truth in a culture where they hear so many wrong messages about sex. Bless us as we try to do that, Father. In Jesus' name, amen.